Right now, it is time for David Taracek and the Media Beat. David joins us live on Fridays, right here around 7:30 to 7:35. We rebroadcast David after our 12 noon news on Monday and also over the course of the weekend as well. Now, David has his own website, themediabeat.us, and David is also a PBS television correspondent, reports on ethics and belief. And we say happy Friday, good Friday, and good morning, David.
And the same to you. I'm reporting in, of course, from the media capital of the world, New York City, as always. And it happens to be, as we speak now, Good Friday. And I'm prompted to think about our business overall and how much it has changed in the last 90 years or so. On Good Friday in 1930, in my old home country of origin, the BBC, that much lauded internationally organization of international news and lauded internationally for it, came up with an extraordinary news broadcast. Do you know what was so important about that historical day, having that day historically for the news business?
I should know it, but I don't.
For the evening news in the 6 o'clock hour, the BBC decided to make this announcement at the beginning of the news bulletin slot. It said, "There is no news tonight."
That should happen.
It was a holiday, of course, so not much was happening. The BBC decided there was no news. I think, you know, as I say, it shows how much has happened in the last century, essentially. I mean, it's no longer a given that the authorities can decide whether or not something is worth transmitting. Of course, the media still, you know, media professionals still have the last word about what particular events do get into a news bulletin or a news broadcast or into news coverage generally. But essentially, the assumption has changed completely. It's the public's right to know has zoomed up to the top of the agenda, I think, compared with where it was in the 1920s and 30s.
You know, the public's right to know is important. It's very important. But I've had several people this week ask me, have I been watching this trial on TV? And I said basically, no. I said it is a gut-wrenching, a heartbreaking event that is going on, and I don't need to see a reconfirmation of the poor witnesses that are up there, that are reliving what happened, and even police that are reliving what happened. Let the trial continue. I hope the scales of justice are correct, but you just can't tell. But I cannot go with the 24-hour coverage and the live coverage of this, David. It's just one of those things that, I don't know, for me, it just doesn't seem right.
I think we differ on this, yeah. Marshall. Yeah. It's absolutely your choice as the consumer of news, as the television viewer, to decide not to watch it. I defend your right to the death there. There's nothing about this that is compulsory. But I think, and the whole basis, and I rest my case, I suppose, on that general adage that is perhaps taken a little too lightly sometimes, but I think needs to be taken very seriously, that not only must justice be done, but it must be seen to be done, too. And there was a lot of legal arguments before this trial happened. The Minnesota court system has previously not been so open about cameras in the courtroom, and one of the main arguments made by Attorney General Keith Ellison, who's a defender a lot of the time of the public's right to know, but has been sticking to the general historic state position, which is that cameras only get into Minnesota courts after a guilty plea or a guilty verdict has been registered. So this is a historic change for Minnesota, and it's based on that adage that that justice must be seen to be done. And as a communicator, I'm strongly in support of that notion. Some of the arguments that the Attorney General used against it were overruled by the court in this by the judge Peter Cahill on the grounds that some of it may be troubling. That was the argument you were turning to, and in a particular legal sense, the Attorney General was turning to the nature of the heightened emotional nature of the proceedings would inevitably have their impact, and the Attorney General's office were worried in particular about witnesses who were expected to come forward later on down the line could be intimidated by what's going on, and that's a fair argument. But the judge overruled it and said that the public interest argument is a stronger one, and I tend to see the sense of that line of argument. I don't believe that anything changes simply because the cameras are in the court. What does change is that there is the opportunity, and it is only the opportunity. Not every individual member of the public has to take it up for this to be true. Not everybody has to watch it for it to be true. That it is available to the public to see, and to see that a man on trial is getting a fair trial, that the process of justice is being pursued in a way that is balanced and fair and effective, that all those elements that count, that make up public interest, are fully being served. I, for one, as a journalist and as someone committed to the justice process, I'm content. I'm not going to say that I'm enjoying the event. I'm certainly not, but I'm very glad that it's being broadcast.
Yeah, I guess my problem with it is these things seem to me. When the defense, it seems more like a trial of George Floyd and his background. Where I guess that's where I fall off on this. His background doesn't have anything to do to me with this case. And
I agree absolutely. Yeah. And it can be a factor. Yeah. It can be taken into account. But the argument that's there to be had, I would trust in a properly conducted courtroom, will allow that argument to take its place, be and be dismissed or argued against forcefully in the way that it should be. What's clear is that of course the defense is taking that line. How many murder cases have you known in the last few decades where that's precisely what defense counsel set out to do all the time? There's nothing special or nothing different about that tactic. What needs to happen, of course, is that it needs to be thrashed out fully and dismissed as potentially the specious tactic that it so often is. And I'm sure the prosecution will be determined to do that. It's very, very clear that that an argument has very strong force, saying it's irrelevant whether this man had a background of drug use or so. There are certain technical arguments, and they will be coming up, whether or not his drug intake around the time of the event had any influence at all on the cause of death that needs to be established as the proceedings go on. In the end, this court case does revolve around what was the actual cause of death for George Floyd. Much of the evidence seems to indicate, well, does indicate very strongly. There's no need to move away from that simple truth, that it was... It was the result of actions by a police officer, and that's why this particular police officer, Derek Chauvin, is on trial. But if the defense wants to try and suggest it was some other cause, well, it's their right too. But the evidence seems pretty overwhelming on the prosecution side here. I can say that as an observer, but of course it has to be thrashed out in the courtroom and in front of the public's eyes, as represented by the courtroom cameras.
You started off with the story about the BBC and there's no news. Hats off to the BBC. They have come up with evidence in one of their investigative reports that uncovered the location of a massacre linking to the military in Ethiopia. It is a eye-opening, startling piece, and I don't know if you've seen it or not.
Yeah, it's a good piece of thoroughgoing research. As I was saying right at the beginning, it's an internationally lauded organization, the BBC, and you know I have my certain mixed feelings about it. I in general applaud its work overall, and it is an extraordinary organization. But I'm not an unrestrained admirer of the BBC. It has its problems, and in fact, although everyone often assumes. People who know me, or don't know me rather well, very well that is, assume that my British broadcasting career was conducted in the BBC. It wasn't. I very rarely worked for the BBC. A few broadcasts for the BBC World Service, a few documentaries for them, but in the main, I was working when I was based in Britain for the commercial television side of the equation, very much the rivals to the BBC. I'm an admiring rival, but I'm able to step away from the BBC as I make my comments about it. But yes, in this particular case, their organization works well on the basis of regional correspondence in different parts of the world, with beneath that, filtering into that, an extraordinary network of stringers who work independently, but are on a kind of retainer basis with the BBC, and that increases their local knowledge, enormously compared with many international organizations that could be compared with the BBC. The BBC is good for its breadth of coverage, and often has very much so in this case in Ethiopia, the depth of their local coverage.
I want to go on to CNN. They've been around. It's hard to believe how long they've been around. But do you remember that Don Farmer passed away at the age of 82, and he was one of the anchors that really was the mainstay in the beginning of CNN, when it was really just an experiment to see if it would really work. And, you know, they talk about Fox News changing the world. I think Ted Turner, when CNN first started, really changed the world of news.
That was the first big change of news on television terms, yes. The whole idea of cable news network was, as you say, an experiment. Not everybody wanted the experiment to be conducted. There were lots of opposition to it, not least, of course, from the established networks' news divisions. I remember the caustic variation on the name of the cable news network, to spell it out completely, CNN. That's what its formal name was, but many in the, I remember an ABC guy christening it the Chicken News Network. Because, of course, it was coming from the South. That kind of northeastern elitism was seeping through into the dismissal of this puny new upstart from the South. And Well, we know the outcome. Cable news network is cable news in general is now pretty much the go-to source for many people, as opposed to they will pick and choose between their particular networks, but cable news in general tends to be way up there in people's viewing menu, by comparison, the established news divisions of the main television, commercial television networks, are left standing much of the time by CNN especially. I think CNN is still the most professional journalistically out of all the cable news networks, and still, although you can't say that they hold to this line always, but still mainly a news network and not an opinion network, although like all cable news, it has to do what it has to do. It has to fill 24 hours, and inevitably talk is used to fill out all that hourage, and so consequently you get that constant tug between what is genuine news and what is opinion about the news. And you and I have talked a lot about this as being possibly the most dangerous thing that has happened to the news business, which is that the dividing line that should exist between news and opinion is being blurred more and more and more. And I'm afraid CNN is not at all innocent in that of that crime either.
We're speaking, of course, with David Terechuk. This is the Media Beat. Now, you asked me to have the call to the post on hand this morning, and I have it on hand.
Well, I'm glad you have it on hand. We've already discussed what I was going to apply it to, but you'll notice that when you play it this week, and you will in a sec, I know, that its tone is a little different. It's not the wild, raucous fanfare. It's just what we need for this week. Let's hear it. Yeah, I just wanted to play it because for it to be, as I say, not a raucous and wild celebration, but it's a sober and restrained recognition, not of an individual this week, but of a raft of professionals just doing their job as fully as they can, and that's what I think the press corps has been doing in the Minnesota courtroom. It's what's been done. It's being done in difficult circumstances for professionals. There's only one court set of court cameras. It's court TV, but it's being pooled, and pool arrangements are never the most favorite way of covering events as far as the press corps are concerned. But oftentimes we have to submit to it for obvious and sensible reasons, as it is in this case. Court TV is covering it, but of course everybody who uses that material is in their debt to Court TV. And similarly, because of the really serious and significant nature of this trial, there are lots of limitations, including the fact that, of course, it's taking place in a time of COVID, where the public are not very well represented in the court either. The defendant Chauvin is allowed a supporter. There is always one member, at least, of the Floyd family in evidence. But generally speaking, it's a pretty empty courtroom, and therefore, we are reliant upon the press corps. And I think they're doing a serious job and doing it well. The Minneapolis Star Tribune is leading the press coverage in print, and we're seeing some very good courtroom coverage from the print press in general too. So that's a muted fanfare this week, but a fanfare nonetheless.
All right, this past week in New York, the governor floated an idea about a travel passport. But taking a look back in England, it's a pretty divisive issue about these COVID passports.
Yeah, it's become, I'm a little puzzled by the degree to which people are reacting emotionally to this idea of being a passport recording what your immunization status is. I don't think I'm alone in this, but I remember a time when we all had the equivalent of we all who travel, that is, travel, beyond our own state or country, we would have our own, we would already have and need to carry our vaccination passports. They're known as the yellow card for the carte jaune from the, from its international usage. It is literally a yellow card that fits in the back of your passport. And every time I needed to go overseas, I would pick up the card and see which of my immunizations are still current. Sometimes, if I was working for a go-ahead organization that made international travel a really important part of its coverage, and I would be traveling overseas for them, then there would be a medical team who would ensure that my medical records were up to date and my vaccinations were current. I'm very grateful to it. I was going often to countries where yellow fever was prevalent, for instance. I mean, it made total sense any traveler to keep a very careful check on what immunizations he or she had, or whether or not they'd expired and whether they need to be renewed. So they used to be, for some of us at least, just a matter of course. And I really don't see why they should suddenly become some kind of privacy issue or whatever else the argument is for not keeping a careful record of one's own immunizations if you want to travel. I think it's the fact that there is a controversy about it now seems to me a sad reflection on on what to my eyes, at least, looks like a bit of opportunistic politicization of an issue that needs not to be, has no need to be politicized.
Yeah, it's you look at this at COVID-19 and you see now all these third and fourth surges that are coming about, and you don't hear them about this from China. And people try to compare China's response to COVID-19 to the rest of the world, but you can't, because China is such a closed country and there's such the government overpresence that people are used to being tracked on a daily basis in China and used to being told what to do on a very, very stern basis, that you just can't compare it to any place else in the world.
Sure, it's closed in the sense that we don't know what's going on. I don't think we necessarily regard every statistical report that comes out of China with anything but a large dose of salt. But also, you're right, it's a regimented, state-controlled country, party-controlled, and right down to, we will well remember, I'm sure, the one-child policy. There is a government that had no problem interfering in citizens' private lives, registration and monitoring is a fact of life. Social behavior is now monitored with a points system for what the party, Communist Party, regards as patriotic behavior is rewarded with high points, what it labels unpatriotic behavior is labeled with knocking off of points. People keeping people's score down, which affects the capacity for getting work and housing and various other things that they regard as privileges, we would regard as just normal human rights. So yeah, it serves the argument no purpose at all to make comparisons with China. But what we do need to recognize, of course, is that citizens have a duty to each other to safeguard each other's health. All the public health system in the Western democratic world can't do anything else but rely upon that supremely. We can't order, or we can, of course, there can be mandates, all sorts of ways that government can interfere or step in, rather, to assist public to assist the public in staying well, and that's been what's happening. But the balance between the mandate and expecting the public common sense to take up the slack has been one of the problems about COVID for many countries, the United States included. Perhaps most, I think, the trouble that some states have had in taking any kind of rigorous state intervention position on this has been one of the problems that we've had the three and now possibly a fourth surge taking us over, even while now in changed circumstances we have a vaccine to help on the positive side at the same time.
And one final thing, David, and as someone who, from both Europe's view and your view as an American citizen, I am just absolutely gobsmacked, amazed at what has happened politically. Joe Biden has put forth this huge, almost Roosevelt-like package to restore the economy. And you find that the Wall Street Journal, the stock market, the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, all very conservative, okay, and are behind this plan. And I think it puts the Republican Party in kind of a weird position, because this is normally the type of plan that the people they depend on support from aren't there for them.
Right. Conservative commentators are very interesting to read at the moment. We seem to be in a position where big government, remember that phrase? is back with us, in a way that just not been seen since the Reagan years, that were devoted to the dismantling of what was then called big government. And I think it's telling that that you should make the comparison to another U.S. president. And that the Rooseveltian expansion of the government's role in our lives in the 30s and 40s is perhaps being repeated in some way. These are desperate times in many ways, and maybe very serious and broad sweeping changes are the only things that that can realistically come out of this, and that's what Biden is offering us. And it's a terrible shock, I'm sure, to lots of purist conservatives, but it is interesting to note that more practically minded conservatives, as you say, the Wall Street Journal is a big example, are actually basking in the prospects of a turnaround in the economy and all the other social changes too that are bound to flow from this massive change in governmental direction that the Biden administration represents.
It is definitely a return to big government, and it does need the support of big business and the stock market and some conservative news outlets, I think, to succeed, to get enough Republicans to come on board.
Well, we'll see how that goes.
David, it's always great to speak to you. We'll check with you next week.
Absolutely.
David Tarachuk with the Media Beat here on Robin Hood Radio. And you can hear the Media Beat on Robin Hood Radio a couple of different ways, live on the air. Also, when we rebroadcast it on the weekends and, of course, Monday after the 12 noon news. And you can get it online, robinhoodradio.com. Click on demand. Click on the Media Beat with David Tarachuk.